FM and KZFR.org. For a little bit of news and information you can use, I am Matt Fidler. This last weekend, Sunday, November 17th, PG&E decided to make an announcement that said, quote, Emergency Operations Center continues to monitor a strong offshore wind event expected to begin early Wednesday morning, November 20th, and last through Thursday morning. To reduce the risk of wildfires in these conditions, PG&E may turn off power to approximately 250,000 customers in portions of 19 counties in the Sierra Foothills, North Valley, and North Bay, end quote. Of those 19 counties, Butte County is, of course, one of those. And, of course, they aren't specific of whose power is likely to be cut off. A good guess would be places like Paradise, Magalia, Forest Ranch, and other more fire-prone areas. Because, as we've all noticed, we have yet to get any real rain. It is dry out there, and combined with wind, as we know, are prime conditions for fire to spread if one ignites. I myself am suspect that PG&E turning off power makes the odds of starting a fire lower. It didn't prevent the Kincaid's fire, but it did cut off flows of information for those who might need it the most, those who live in fire-prone areas. When those folks don't have power, they are much less likely to receive crucial information. So this is my request. If you were put in danger or majorly inconvenienced by these power shutoffs, let PG&E know. Then they can weigh the pros and cons about doing this. You can do this by visiting pge.com and clicking on the Contact PG&E link at the top right of the website. Please include specifics about what you experienced and be polite and considerate. The folks answering these communications were and are not responsible for the fires or the power outages. They are just regular folks doing their job. If you are mean and aggressive in your communications, the content of your message will likely be ignored. That being said, prepare yourself for possible blackouts. Get batteries for your flashlights. Eat your leftover food in the refrigerator and get some dry ice for your freezer. Fill up your car with gas, and we're all going to get past this, and hopefully we're going to get some rain soon. I want to end on a positive note. Are you tired of hearing of how divided our country is? How there is a conservative America and a liberal America, and that we just don't get along or believe in the same things? Well, I reject that notion. I, for one, believe there's only Dolly's America. Yes, Dolly Parton. Seriously, she's like the modern-day Bob Marley, uniting a tumultuous world with her music and message. And there is an awesome podcast out by Jad Abumrad, you know, the guy who created Radiolab. It's called Dolly's America. If you're feeling low about the state of the world, check it out. She is such an amazing, uniting figure of all walks of life. If you just listen to it, I think you're going to feel a little bit better about the world and maybe yourself. For KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico, I'm Matt Fidler.
All right. Good evening, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to KZFR. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And this evening at 6 p.m. to 7 p.m., this is the Youth for Justice program. My name is Steven, and I'm in here in the studio with a lot of good friends of mine who will be getting introduced here shortly. Before we get rolling, I'd like to just shout out the folks who make this show possible. So, Youth for Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, your local state, local partner to the California Arts Council. Since 2001, Friends of the Arts have been creating economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and spreading the word out about arts and culture through their bi-monthly newsletters. To stay in the know about the arts or have your event listed, visit friendsof.art and stay in touch. And by Sativa Art Glass Studio, creating internationally acclaimed art glass since 1977. You can experience the magic of Sativa Art Glass by visiting their gallery in Chico at 819 Wall Street, Tuesday through Saturday from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at sativa.com. All right, thank you to our supporters who make this happen. And again, if you're just tuning in, this is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And a quick disclaimer that the opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. All right. So, again, this is the Youth for Justice program, and we have a really exciting program set for y'all today. We're going to talk about a really, really important event taking place tomorrow, and then we're going to roll into an interview of a new project that my good buddy Bill and I, who's sitting right next to me, are getting off the ground here shortly. And so before we get into that interview, I want to just talk about something happening tomorrow, which hopefully many of you have heard about, and it's a climate strike. So, if you didn't know, we are facing a climate crisis. And over the past year or so, there have been an incredible amount of young people taking to the streets and stopping business as usual to draw attention to this crisis. And if you saw in the news back in September, almost 8 million people went on strike to demand that we take transformative action to address this climate crisis. And out here in Chico, we were in the City Plaza on September 20th, and we had almost 700 people to come out and show that they want something to happen on this crisis, that they are tired of what's been taking place and the inaction that we've been seeing. And so tomorrow, across the country, there's going to be almost 300 cities that are striking, that are stopping, they're leaving school, leaving work, and coming together to sit in the offices, to rally, to do banner drops, and to really make this issue unavoidable. And so we're going to take just a couple of minutes here to talk about what's going on tomorrow. And in the studio here, right here with me, I have Cece from the Inspire School of Arts and Sciences. And she's going to talk a little bit about what she's going to be doing tomorrow and kind of her thoughts on this important day. And Cece, do you want to just introduce yourself to the people and kind of say where you're coming from and how you got involved in this? And then we can talk about the strike.
Yeah, I am Cece. I go to Inspire School of the Arts and Sciences, like Steven said. I'm a sophomore in high school. I'm 15. And I kind of got involved. I've always been pretty politically active since the 2016 elections was when I first started kind of getting into it. And then I got asked a week before the last strike to do a speech because they didn't have enough people. And so, you know, I kind of prepared that, and it was really fun, and I really enjoyed it, and I really agreed with everything everyone said, and just the energy there was super cool, and it was just very empowering and exciting to be there, and yeah, so that's basically how I got involved, and ever since, I have been really involved. I started a club at school called Politically Active Teens Club, yes. So yeah, that's basically how I got involved, and yeah.
Cool. I'm so glad that you did. You were an incredible speaker last time. Actually, you're getting requests to speak at future events because of that, and I'm not even sure if you know. But we'll talk about that later. But yeah, so how are you feeling about tomorrow's strike? What are you looking forward to? What's your role in tomorrow's strike? And what do you kind of hope to come from tomorrow?
I am so excited for tomorrow. Tomorrow's going to be really cool. We have a lot going on, a lot of cool events, a lot of cool speakers, musicians, bands, music, workshops, and all that. So I'm super excited. It's going to be, I hope, have the same energy as the last strike, as well as the idea of, you know, we're going to actually get some action this time, and we're not going to just get, you know, praise from political leaders or whatever that may be. We're going to get some action, and that's what I'm really excited about, is drawing a lot of attention. Yeah. My role has just been sort of recruitment of high school students to come, because that's, you know, the group we're trying to reach the most. That's the most powerful group in this movement, in my opinion. So yeah, I'm just really excited for, you know, the energy. I really liked the energy last time.
Yeah, me too. It was really powerful. And recruiting the people, that's the hard work. So thanks for doing that. It's hard to mobilize folks. And if you're hearing us talk about this and you're wondering, where is the strike? Well, how can I join it? It's actually going to be on Chico State's campus tomorrow, Friday, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. And we're going to be at the breezeway into the library and the plaza right next to that breezeway. And you'll see us out there. You'll see the signs. You'll hear the speakers. So we look forward to seeing you all out there anytime between 9 and 4 tomorrow on campus. And that is my cue to roll into the next segment of this episode. So thank you, Cece, for giving us that intro, and we'll come back at the end of the show and talk a little bit further. And so the next portion, we're going to roll into an interview that my good buddy Bill Mash here, who's the technical man and the visionary behind this whole program, worked on with Ali Meadows Knight and Mel Figueroa. And they're going to just briefly introduce what this interview you're about to hear is. and then we'll roll into that, and then we'll follow up with some Q&A afterwards. So, Ali, either of you, you want to talk just briefly about what we're about to hear?
Yeah, hey, Tunani, Chico. Hey. We're going to be having, this is a really expansive, but this is traditional ecological knowledge and how we can work as a community to create sustainable ecosystems for a long period of time to have a healthy forest or have healthy forest, clean water, and a healthy community.
As the indigenous scholar Nick Estes has said, indigenous people have already survived climate change, a zombie apocalypse, and an alien invasion. And so, you know, a lot of us who come from colonized peoples, from indigenous peoples, we still carry the, you know, knowledge and pieces of people who survived. And, you know, as a lot of people are very, very nervous and going through a lot of climate grief right now. And, you know, we're basically trying to say, like, you know, there is something we can do about it. You know, our people survived, and we can help everyone survive as well.
And there's always a story to be told about how the fire needed to be stolen, and all of the traditional the folks here. There's stories about fire and the characters, the birds, and the different characters that stole the fire back for the people. And now I look at it like, you know, we're looking at our new neighbors and the new people that are here, and it's very interesting that I am the character that helps you steal the fire back.
Let's steal the fire back.
Let's steal it back. And I'm intrigued. If you're on air and you just heard that, I don't know how you couldn't. I don't think I'm going to say anything else except this interview you're about to hear is the first project, the first story from Imagining Community, which is an effort to really strengthen and empower the community here in Chico and tell the stories of folks who are doing incredible work in different areas. And so this is the first interview from that project, and we're going to roll into that right about now.
Hello, Guillaume Ramesh here, founder and lead Imagineer with Imagining Community, a grassroots media and civic engagement endeavor, sharing stories that make our community imagination sparkle and engage. Our first story, Unsuppressing Traditional Knowledge, focuses on traditional ecological knowledge, fire suppression, Machupta tribal knowledge, and the ruthless North American indigenous genocide. Our program tonight airs a synopsis of this story, condensed from 90 minutes of airtime from last Friday's KZFR Peace and Social Justice show, and features Stephen Ross Brannon, a wildland firefighter, Mel Figueroa, a PhD candidate from the University of Berkeley, who has been studying wildland maintenance and restoration, and Ali Metters Knight, a Machupta tribal member, artist, and traditional ecological knowledge instructor. We start our segment this evening with Ali Metters Knight focusing on Machupta tribal knowledge and the ghastly suppressed facts about the North American genocide of indigenous people at the hands of cutthroat colonizers who painted Native Americans as prehistoric Neanderthals. Here on People Power Radio. Got this new group we put together called Imagining Community, and it's a grassroots media and civic engagement organization broadcasting stories that make our community imagination sparkle and engage. And we're here to enlighten, nurture, and expand community engagement. So how that rolls out is we're going to be, myself and other journalists and other people that are on the creative team, we're going to be telling long-form stories. We're going to follow this for a couple of 2 or 3 months and do audio-video work around it and some written word. So the question I have for you around that whole mouthful there was, you know, what is the story to be told these next few months, Ali? Where should we be pointing our cameras and our microphones and our pens?
So right now, I believe that it is time for us to take action. The last time, few times I've spoken, done a presentation on working on creating a 20-year land management contract for the federal government. I've had to explain to people that, and it sounds a little bit morbid, but very honest, there's no other way to say it. My dead self is talking to my live self saying, do it now. And what I have to do now is wake up at least people around me to help support me at this point, and then get a big bunch of support to go ahead and get the community involved in doing restoration of our forests. and to actually bring money in the next 20 years into this community by working on the land, by working on our forests, and creating knowledge that we can pass down for generations, because we need to have survivable ecosystems here during climate change. And I definitely think it's possible that our community can band together and do this and represent what other communities can do throughout the nation by supporting Indigenous folks, by collaborating with their tribal neighbors, and giving the tribes the authority to manage the land and to make it an actual economy using everything in the forest.
What kind of organizations do you think will be intermingling with or reaching out to or also being part of this project?
So I believe that the Fire Safe Council to put an insert in the last CNR about the forest health and all the programs and projects we've worked on. So I think we should be working. They've done such an excellent job with collaborating and partnering with everybody and sustaining such good relationships. I would like to go that as a tribal member and working with the tribe, I'd like to go after funding to make that a huge collaboration and a huge project. And I'd love to have them talk about their story of how they collaborated through all these years and survived and created such an inspiration for me that I don't have to reinvent the wheel. I've come this far, and I feel very impressed with the Fire Safe Council beyond words, and I really like to put them.
Anyone else come to mind? Or we'll just kind of dovetail off of that maybe once we start talking to the Fire Safe Council.
Yeah, I think Cal Fire is like a really good start with other tribes in the area, and they have done traditional ecological knowledge, TEK, and I haven't really collaborated with them as far as south here, north of here, mm-hmm. yes. But they usually speak for themselves, and they get into their certifications in their local area and in their territory. We also have a really good opportunity for the students at Chico State, the students at Paradise High School, the students within our community to have a great opportunity to learn more than just what they have collegially within their classrooms, We can have classrooms outside for them, and that's what I'm excited about too.
I want to make sure that, you know, at the end of those 2 or 3 months, Allie, that our listeners and maybe some viewers understand what the Menchupta tribe is and what their history is and what they bring to the table as far as restoring and imagining a community here in Butte County.
Yeah, there's a lot of history. When I came out in 1993 and started studying it, I had just as innocent and colonized mind than anybody else. So I had a lot to learn. I had a lot of growing to do. I had a lot of places to go. I had a lot of embarrassing comments that I didn't understand and I asked questions about, especially about colonization and whether it all had to happen for a reason. And I've discovered that it shouldn't have happened and that there was a lot of ignorant killers that were allowed to do what they did. And there was a moment that there was thought that there was no reconciliation. But ignorance upon ignorance upon ignorance is now killing everybody on the floor right here on the valley floor, not only through chemicals, but through poor management of ecosystems, through dredging, through mining, and now through suppression of fire and just suppression of Indigenous knowledge. So the more we resist and push back and don't break open that history mm-hmm. and look at it for what it is, then we're kind of resisting the knowing the Menchupta folks and how this worked out. So knowing how many 250,000 Menchupta were here in the early 1800s and how fast the population went down and how vulnerable they were once they survived epidemics, that to see crews of people come and kill and scalping them and having the only protection to be working for a white rancher, and this is after the Civil War, I think people have a hard time wrapping their minds around that. So the history of the Menchupta is that of somebody who is probably your most wisest, oldest neighbor that's probably been the most abused, neglected, and hurt. But very resilient, very, very kind, and still willing to work with everybody to make it better, because it's not so much bygones be bygones. It's that our children live together. Our grandchildren are going to live together. So we must show them how to do it. You know, coming from a place of historical knowledge, the suppression of knowledge, is not so much even in our school systems. It's also, yeah, in our radio stations, on our television. It's even at our dinner tables when we speak. A lot of community members that I speak to, I do lectures and I talk about the historical genocide that took place here. And you know, I get very sharp tongued when I speak of colonizers.
There's some anger there.
Yeah.
There should be. Yeah.
And there is some resistance. And sometimes the resistance is basically that, how can I feel bad now for what happened to your ancestors when you're doing fine now, I'm doing fine now, and that's in the past. And it's almost like a complete gaslighting with like an abuser with such a defensive posture, that I tend to want to believe that it's important for me to keep going and just reinforcing that history, because eventually those people will break.
Yeah.
They will break under the fact that they can no longer argue that it's irrelevant. If I carry I carry the genocidal pain in my heart,
yeah,
even if I don't want to, but even a colonizer carries genocidal pain in their heart for being a killer.
Yeah, I believe that.
We don't escape it, so we can only heal together. But you're looking at what, 1400s contact on the East Coast, and then you have what, 1863, they're still slaughtering all the way over here in California. So almost 400 years of slaughtering people. You can't just undo all that ignorance.
You can't.
And it's hard, but I am not going to stop, but I am definitely undeterred. And I even went to a lecture with a Chico State professor at the library who was doing a lecture to the community about natives and his assertion as a studious professor who is non-native and fully white. And he had no problems explaining that natives from 1850 or 1840s prior to white contact are definitely labeled prehistoric.
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 How does it feel as a tribal member to be, you know, identified as prehistoric?
I really label it to being primitive and Neanderthal. I could definitely see why it excites the Christian to believe they've done something right when they've been able to say you killed a primate who is not evolved, a human evolved, like a deficient human who wasn't as elite and who didn't evolve with European class and structure. Very ignorant. By far, something I would think would be something completely devastating after you died to realize was a lie.
Yeah, it's definitely a lack of communication, because the Native Americans certainly knew a lot more about how to take care of the land, right? Because if you're the colonizers, I like your term, because it really puts a spin on it. We're here to take your land. They're not so much interested in propping the Indians up for all of their knowledge. They want you to think that they're prehistoric people. They're, you know, just came out of the cave, and we're here to help them. We're going to give them Christianity, and, well, we'll kill a few of them along the way. That's how I look at it.
Collateral damage.
Collateral damage.
Yeah. We really haven't appreciated the massacres and the things that's happened recently. Even to this day, there's somebody who would like to do his own version of these Pence Ranch kids that were killed, and their story about who killed them and why they had to slaughter so many Indians in this area in order to save all of the white children. And then they formed a group called the Supreme Order of Caucasians here in Chico. And these were a murderous, racist group, and they still have pretty much a similar following today, with a group of citizens that have a very similar mindset that they're being invaded by a minority or people that don't belong here, and they have to remove them. And it cycles here very often. And it never really quite hits people that, you know, we look at the genocide in the United States with Native Americans. And I say Native because I'm naming all the tribes on
right.
this whole island.
Right.
We're talking about 100 million people dying as a form of genocide. Even look at the Holocaust in Germany. We're not looking at 100 million, but that's the label that United States has on just one specific area, just natives,
mm-hmm.
just Native Americans, not talking about any other country around the world, but just here at home, 100 million Natives had to die for this to make America what it is today. And if that's not the closest thing to Jesus Christ, I don't know what is.
Maybe one thing to land on real quick before we do closing comments, there's this age old, it's not my quote, but it's like, if you find that you're all on the same hill screaming the same things, you know, maybe you need to find a new hill. And I think so often people that are open to looking at the truth and knowledge feel like if they do, they can't stay on that hill. But my comment is maybe you're on the wrong hill anyway, and maybe there's a better hill for you.
Yeah, yeah.
And than the racist, misogynist, and so, genocide hill. It's probably a better hill.
They
for
can
you.
Say they have that hill. I want to give them that mountain.
Yeah,
definitely,
keep that mountain.
That mountain is overgrown. It's got fire suppression. They don't know how to tend to the land around it, so they can have that hill. And that's why I think it's really important that I'm looking at forest health and looking at the environment and ecosystem, a 20-year contract. I'm going to be working with every piece of the community from every color, from every creed. And there are going to be some white supremacists there. There are going to be some racist folks. There's going to be some non-racist folks that are open-minded. There are going to be some folks that never
all
even heard
of
Machupta.
A lot of hills.
A lot of hills. But I think this is the great where we work together and make those changes. When we work together to fix the land, it's going to change a lot.
The hills are alive with the sound of restoration.
There it is.
There it is. We can come up with a whole, we should do a whole sound of the music, like take off on
I
that.
I like it.
All right. I'm really looking forward to this project. Any closing comments?
Alba wasn't too harsh. I tend to be a little angry when I talk about colonizers. I even told somebody to, we need to change the general plan of Chico. And our plan, any type of plan that quotes Annie Bidwell on ecology. Annie Bill was a colonizer. She had no understanding of the ecology of this area, and she's simply donated land that she should have given back to the Machupta tribe, but instead gave it to the citizens of Chico, gave us a couple $100 after she died. And I think it's important that my legacy is to take her name out of the ecology and out of the general plan of this town and put Machupta's name instead. I've seen the faces and some of the things that I've had to say and how it hurts. And I said, I'm sorry. You know, I was like, I could see that I've hurt some people. Decolonization is uncomfortable, at least talking on a historical sense of decolonization. And so I was like, please go to your healing tent. So if I hurt anyone, I hope you have a healing tent.
The first voice you'll hear in our traditional ecological knowledge segment is Mel Figueroa, a PhD candidate from the University of Berkeley who has been studying wildland maintenance and restoration. Our second speaker is Allie Meadows Knight, a Machupta tribal member artist and traditional ecological knowledge instructor here on People Power Radio.
The thing is that we need to start now, right? And that's part of it. We're trying to really, you know, in this moment where all of us are in the same place of trying to figure out what to do now that, you know, the reality of climate change has really kind of hit us, right? Is, you know, being able to use this moment where we're all searching to be able to, you know, start something now because we can't wait for 20 years.
No.
We can't wait until another 3 fires have burned through here or it's been flooded out. You know, we got the first rain on November 27th.
Yeah.
Right. You know, it's starting now. And so we need to move now because it will take a while for these results to show themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a slow but steady process, not usually one we're used to, but one we have to just keep working at. Traditional ecological knowledge is sort of to acknowledge that what indigenous people had built over the last 20,000 years on this continent isn't just about spiritual practice. It's not just about culture. It was a science and it was a scientific method that was practiced by indigenous peoples to manage their landscape. So part of what TEK is about is that we're used to thinking about domestication in terms of like one species, like a plant or an animal. What indigenous peoples did all over North and South America is what we call landscape domestication. So they weren't just hunter and gatherers, just, you know, living along the whims of nature. They shaped nature to an incredible extent to improve hunting grounds, fishing weirs, gathering places. Doing that over and over, season after season, actually shaped the landscape that they lived in. And so the landscapes adapted to them as much as they adapted to the landscapes.
How much land is there in Butte County, federal land, that would be underneath this proposal?
Yeah, about 180,000 acres.
Wow.
And the capacity under this grant, this 20-year grant, is up to 3,000.
To 3,000? So you couldn't do the whole 180?
What we can do is subcontracts. So
3,000 a contract. Okay.
There's a master stewardship contract, and then there's a number of subcontracts. Part of what the certification program is about is, again, getting people trained up in the skills and knowledge, and also like kind of a perspective that's really needed to do forestry on, like, in the way that indigenous peoples did, giving indigenous authority its due.
So let's just talk a bit about the semantics. So if you can manage up to 3,000 acres, you work through your certification process, and you've got, you know, someone that's going to manage that 3,000 acres. Does the government, you know, have grants that you go after to help get money to maintain the land? How does the money flow?
So this is part of originally what I had even proposed through my first business plan, was that we would able to create an economic base through all the supplies and goods found in the forest. So this would be a sustainability plan. So unlike getting a grant every year that you just draw down, say, $1 million to $2 million every year, and then you process and do your subcontractors, and you basically have to show dollar for dollar what was spent, and it's a very strange procurement. So this would actually allow all of the goods to be managed for the project. Mm-hmm. So the federal government basically pays the first phase of the project as you do setup, and then you should be sustaining yourself from then on.
Is there homesteading involved?
There absolutely should be. So similar to the CCC camps in the 1930s, the Civilian Conservation Corps, we would be doing workforce housing, not according to the extractive economy, but according to the needs of the land management. So there would be like riverine stations and forest stations, and also the biomass, you know, as Ali said, the biomass and the goods that are collected from fuel removal and stuff can be used for timber for the housing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Even the clays could be used to make cob homes, which are fire resistant, by the way. You know, I mean, part of the sort of counterintuitive logic of fire adapted landscape like this is that in order to prevent wildfires, you have to move more people into the forest. The forest needs to be actively managed year over year.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, where a lot of people are saying, oh, no growth in the urban wildland interface, we're actually saying we need the right kind of settlement on the urban wildland interface in order to make everybody safe.
What would this workforce housing look like? Kind of like the same as the CC model. Sometimes they'd set up camps, tents. Sometimes they'd build little cabins, all the above.
Well, because I'm looking at it from the tribal perspective as the lead agency, mm-hmm. I'm hoping that the tribal government that we have, Machupta, which is a government, it is a sovereign government, they would be developing their own building codes and regulations.
Got it. Okay.
That would be complementary to the city or county, but would probably be more accommodating to the supplies and things provided in the forest for a good reason.
The thing is that we need to start now.
Yeah.
Right? And that's part of it. We're trying to really, you know, in this moment where all of us are in the same place of trying to figure out what to do now that, you know, the reality of climate change has really kind of hit us.
Right.
Is, you know, being able to use this moment where we're all searching to be able to, you know, start something now,
mm-hmm.
because we can't wait for 20 years.
No.
We can't wait until another three fires have burned through here or it's been flooded out. You know, we got the first rain on November 27th.
Yeah.
Right. You know, it's starting now. And so we need to move now, because it will take a while for these results to show themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so It's a slow but steady process, not usually one we're used to, but one we have to just keep working at.
Maybe we can land, before we close, on how folks can get involved or learn more, or all of the above.
So the progress right now, we're pretty much in phase one. We've met with the county. We've meeting with Fire Safe Council. We're meeting with any and every entity that is willing to reach out. TEKstewardship@gmail.com. It's TEKstewardship@gmail.com is a way to contact us. And we're together just making meetings and collaborating. We're also bringing those partnerships and collaborations with the tribe. I'm a Machupta Indian tribe. We're in the first phase of that. We'll be doing outreach with two other tribes, not only in our area, but other tribes who have experience with traditional ecological programs, who also have done traditional fires, and who have done stewardship programs through the Farm Bill in the past. And we definitely want to collect all that data. The grant is due in August 2020.
So we would just Google Farm Bill 2019 to find the actual bill?
No.
18, it passed in 18?
Yeah, if you go to the U.S. Forest Service website and look up stewardship contracting, there are resources there. There's some PowerPoint presentations where, you know, kind of shows you sort of the basics of it, and a brochure that basically says what the stewardship contract is.
And we're going for the 20-year end result stewardship contracting specifically.
All right, Guillermo Mash here from, and I'm really pleased to do a pre-record here Wednesday before the Thanksgiving Day with Allie Meadors Knight, the reigning Beck Environmentalist of the Year and Traditional Ecological Knowledge Lecturer, as well as Ross Brannon, a wildland firefighter. I think I'll start with you, Ross. Why don't you give our listeners just a little bit more background on Ross Brannon and how it relates to the work you do in the wildland forest fire suppression, and you put them out too.
Yes. I currently work for the U.S. Forest Service, and what we do, we'll go out, we'll do fuels reduction, we'll cut dead trees down, we'll cut fire breaks, typically meaning that we'll scrape the soil down to bare mineral to where the fire can't burn through dirt. Yeah, then we'll do prescribed burns, and we'll burn off all the dead stuff, do understory burns, just to promote a healthier forest.
What about you, Allie?
I'm a local Machupta tribal member, and so for the last 10 years explicitly, I've been teaching and trying to promote traditional ecological knowledge and working with Don Hinkins and CSUC to promote traditional fire, to bring fire back to the landscape of Butte County, and to teach children and the community the benefits of a healthy fire and a healthy ecosystem based on fire.
Well, nice. Why don't we land on that, since we have a firefighter here? Why don't we talk a little bit about these prescribed burns and traditional burns, and, you know, what that means for our community, our imagining community?
So imagining our community with a healthy fire is looking at healthy historical viewpoints on traditional knowledge, looking at the indigenous knowledge of fire and firescapes, landscapes, fire regimens as very intelligent, wise, made decisions for long-term, large-scale ecosystem health. And once we can kind of do the paradigm shift in our minds that natives were not primitive and undeveloped, but they actually had a great engineering idea for a huge landscape, and if we could go back and appreciate that and acculturate that knowledge into today's workforce, labor force, to bring in labor force into our forests, and to bring people back into the landscapes where they need to be tending and doing restoration. I think that is what I see as the future of Butte County: a healthy fire and healthier people working on the landscape, doing restorative work to our ecosystems.
First and foremost, our most important firefighting tools are all things that the natives started doing. That's cutting fire breaks, prescribed burns. As far as fighting fire, those are the two most effective methods. Of course, you know, this is before aircraft were around, which most of the stuff's done on the ground. The aircrafts are there to help, but ultimately it's fought by men and women on the ground.
And what are some of those tools that you're looking? I know you're out there doing the work right now, Allie. What does some of these things look like as far as, you know, prescribed burns, traditional burns, maybe the difference between the two?
Well, I look at prescribed burns as more of accommodating CAL FIRE and some of the state and federal regulatory fire policies that have been laid out for almost hundreds of years here in California. Some of them do need to be reconsidered and looked at with an acculturation of indigenous knowledge. And then traditional burns are really like almost more casual and less fear-based. So there's less need to wear lots of equipment. There's less need to spend specialized teams of people digging very long. We could use deer breaks for, say, a break and a deer trail instead of a break, and to recognize that knowledge. And to also, maybe we don't have to do core samples of the earth to see if it's a good time to burn, which wastes good opportunity to do underscore burns. So the traditional burning is a lot more, I would say, laissez faire, like happy, right. We're community oriented, where a prescribed burn is a lot more regiment, a little bit more military like and policy. Mm-hmm. We can blend the two, and so, but definitely there is some distinctions between them.
Contrasting to that traditional burn, how long do those burns last, Allie?
Oh, days.
Days. Yeah, good point. Yeah.
I mean, and especially if the community is involved. So when I was in Orleans, California, and they had this TREX program, so it wasn't so much a traditional burn, it was a slightly more cultural and prescribed mix together. The tribal members all had hard hats and fire coats on just to accommodate. But other than that, there was a lot of traditional use of knowledge all through the night. So you could see through the night, go out on your porch and just see this small, thin red line that was creeping up the hill, and there was workers all around, so every path was thought out. They even used drones, they used all kinds of equipment to make sure they've navigated, and they've got even they even look at ivy and grapevines that have big roots, because grapevines like to take the fire into the ground. Mm-hmm. And so there's all these fun things you get to learn where these are all documented and notified. So it takes days to assess and look at everything, and you recover stuff. There's a lot of cultural things to recover after a fire, not only, you know, after the sticks burn back, but twisty sticks, rocks. There's just all kinds of things that are missing and looked at. And yeah, it takes days to go through that. And it's usually fun.
Well, would you like to add to all that, Ross?
I would say that most of the fuels reduction work that we're doing is actually combating that the fire suppression that we've been doing for the last 100 years. Like, so we've been having to fix what we've done. Like last year, we had multiple fires that were over 100,000 acres out here in California. We had the Mendocino Complex, which was over 400,000. Like, everyone I was on last year was over 100,000. Obviously, all the suppression that we've done has really caused a pileup, and it's really causing things to change. And just to give another idea at like how long some of these burns can last. So the last thing I was on this year was a fire that was just above Quincy, and it had been burning since July when we got out there. And we got out there at the end of October. These smoke jumpers came out there. These two guys were watching and monitoring this fire that started from a lightning strike that eventually got up to like 7 acres. Just kind of stayed there. They were observing it. We had a huge wind event where there were 60 mile per hour gusts. It didn't go anywhere. I would say the primary reason for that is there was already proper timber spacing there. There wasn't a whole bunch of dead stuff. Like, it looked like it had been treated before. However, they brought what's called a fire use module up there, which fire use modules, these guys are fully self-sufficient. It's pretty impressive. They bring all their own food. Like, they bring all this equipment to monitor fires. They're not fighting it. They just monitor it. So they called us in to cut line around this thing and increase the size of it to burn off the parts that would be beneficial. We tied the end of the line into an alder stand because alder doesn't burn. It's not gonna blow up. It might smolder, but it's not gonna burn. And so finally, after 2 months of this thing burning, they put fire on the ground and it slowly burned off. And You know, I've had to check the status of it. I would not be surprised if it's not 100% out right now. It's because of
just finishing out this interview here, which we have two of our interviewees right in the studio with us. Ali and Mel are here. And we're going to hand it over to them. Before we do that, I just want to give a shout-out to the folks who make this possible. And that is due to the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and Dr. Michael Shuel, clinical psychologist, offering psychotherapy for adults and play therapy for children. Dr. Shuel helps people find meaning and depth in their lives and deal with issues including depression, anxiety, and trauma. Dr. Shuel also works with children as young as 5. Located in Chico, Dr. Shuel can be reached at 891-6292. And by Baird Roofing Company. For a hole in your roof or a whole new roof, Baird Roofing Company has been serving Butte County for more than 30 years. Whether it's re-roofing an existing structure or a first-time roof for new construction, Baird Roofing has got you covered. More information at bairdroofingco.com or by calling 342-1631. That's 342-1631. Or stopping in at 11025 The Midway. And thank you to our underwriters who do make this Youth for Justice program possible. And again, this is 90.1 KZFR. And I like to just talk quickly about the mission of KZFR, because I think it's important to note that we are here in the studio to enlighten, entertain, inform, and educate our listeners in support of community. And that's what we do here on this program. And to continue that, I'm going to hand the mic over to Ali and Mel, who you just heard in that interview. A really powerful interview. And my main thing is kind of how can if folks get involved with what they just heard? And yeah, what else would you like folks to know?
Well, I think first of all, one of the things that folks have got to realize, decolonizing minds is really, really important. And I think part of what decolonization is, I mean, a lot of times the way that it's been talked about is that it's kind of like an abstract notion of justice. You know, I mean, it's very important to do land acknowledgements. It's very important to remember. But I think what we're talking about here in terms of ecological stewardship is that, you know, decolonizing our minds and the land is a very physical and ecological and practical thing. You know, it requires us to look differently at what we know of as environmentalism. It requires us to, you know, get out of a conservation mindset and into a management mindset, that we are the keystone species of the earth. We are the keystone species of the land. And this is something that indigenous peoples all over the world have known for a very long time. We lost that knowledge when colonization happened, you know, like, or that we lost that consciousness, right? When capitalism and extracting profit and exploiting labor in the earth became the norm. So we just got to establish new norms. And that means listening to people who still have this knowledge. It means, you know, saying that, you know, we, as I said in the interview, you know, thinking about different people who look differently as authorities over the knowledge of the earth and the way we have a relationship with it.
Many times, to support what we're doing with the 2018 Farm Bill, the application for this contract, it's a 20-year stewardship contract. This is going to take the whole county, Butte County, not only to support this with their minds and their understanding, but to also look at this as the new workforce. This is your new job for the next 20 years. How do you fit in to a federal contract that stewards and takes and manages that federal land for 20 years? There is an opportunity through the tribe to do traditional ecological certifications to increase the pay of everybody who gets contracted through TEK managing these forests. So there will not be minimum wage jobs. They will be way above minimum wage jobs with a TEK certification. So please understand that the support of this program in the community that will take place for the next 20 years, will not only provide certifications to do stewardship to the forests, it will provide jobs, really, really good paying jobs. And so the support is also in the county. You may need to look at who you are electing that support and do not support this. But I will note that this 2018 Farm Bill is a Republican bill and supported by Republicans. So we can stand as a bipartisan party in this county and this country and at this point to work on managing our forests under these contracts. Mm-hmm. So we are all in this together, every single one of us. And this is our grandchildren. This is our future. And this is the next destiny we're about to see. This is the transformation that the fire has created for us. And I am very, very honored to lead the way.
And if you're interested in more information, if you have an organization that you want to get involved, please email us. We have an email address, tekstewardship@gmail.com. That's tekstewardship@gmail.com.
Wow. Well, we're both this county. At least this county is very fortunate to have you both leading that charge here. And I'm really excited just to see the progress and support how I can. A lot of things I want to touch on there. But I know that there is something happening Sunday that folks can come out to and kind of continue this discussion in some degree. Do you want to touch on that event going on at Blackbird? On Sunday, we're going to be seeing a documentary, I believe.
Yeah, I had put in, during my interview, I spoke of 100 million indigenous native people here in the United States, native to this area now known as the United States. 100 million souls were lost during the colonization and breakdown of this nation. 1 million souls. And this massacre that took place over a long hundreds of years of time, it's documented in a film called The Canary Effect. And this Canary Effect also brings government officials, clippings from Congress, Senate hearings, and government programs that show the absolute intention of genocide against Native tribes here in the United States. So I'm basically just hosting the film. We'll be listening to the film, watching the film. And I basically want to take it from that direction of just acknowledging the genocide and basically atrocities that took place and knowing where we can go forward from here, which I am going to be directing very, very, very clearly that we will be doing our restitution, our reparations by doing ecosystems restorations and working together to repair the land and the landscape and to bring fire back to protect our communities for the next hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yep. There's a direct correlation between the health of the land and the health of people. And, you know, not just the Canary Effect is a really, really, it just hits you in the gut how the mistreatment and the genocide and the, you know, dehumanization of the indigenous people also hurt the land as well. And that connection was broken. And so, I'm actually holding this book in my hand right now by Benjamin Madley, which is called The American Genocide, the United States and the California Indian Catastrophe. A lot of people in California don't actually even know that there are indigenous people still here in California. When I teach about California at UC Berkeley, I ask the students, you know, how many people here know an indigenous person? And they're like, they don't, you know? And so to bring back this history, this, not to shame people, but to just help people understand that we are in this situation because of this 180 years, and that, you know, we can begin to heal it by healing the land because of that unbreakable connection between the land and the societies that it supports.
I don't have too much more to say other than to be there this Sunday at Blackbird to continue this conversation. Because these two incredible people have a lot of knowledge to share with you. And so you can watch this Canary Effect documentary with us this Sunday at Blackbird. We're going to be from 5:30 to 7 p.m. Blackbird's at 1431 Park Ave. Highly, highly encourage you all to come on out, engage, learn, engage, and build community, and really support this effort to restore the land using the practices that we know work. Have you ever thought there was, have you ever doubted the fact that there could be good, meaningful work in restoring the ecosystems? Then these people are going to show you that that's actually true and that it's going to happen. There are good green jobs coming this way in this county, largely because of what Ali and Mel are doing, and I'm really grateful for both of them to do that and be able to promote that. And you know, the change that they're calling for, some might think it's drastic, some might think it's unprecedented, some might think it's transformative. I don't necessarily think that's the case, but some people do. But the results that they're striving for, and the impact that they're trying to make, is really exactly what the climate movement, I think, in the United States now is calling for. Maybe not as directly as they lay out here, but we are aligned in very similar values, and we do have similar visions. And that's a lot of what we are calling for tomorrow and across the country when people take to the streets. As we mentioned earlier in the program, tomorrow is a nationwide climate strike. Almost 300 cities are holding rallies or sit-ins or some sort of public event where people are walking out of school, walking out of work, to really just stop business as usual and demand an end to the continual prioritization of profit over people and the continual destruction of land in the communities who suffer the most due to the practices that have led us to a climate crisis. And we would love for you, if you're listening, even if you're not, to be there tomorrow when we have our rally here in Chico. We're actually going to be there all day on campus at Chico State, right under the breezeway at the library from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. We're going to be engaging in a lot of different things. We're going to hear from folks. We're going to be just having discussions and teach-ins. We're going to have performances. We're going to share food. We're going to be doing all the types of things that we think we need to be doing, given that we're living in a crisis. And it should be a lot of fun. And before we close out here, I do want to just hand it over to one of the people who have been helping to lead the organization behind this, been organizing the students at Inspire in Chico High. It was an incredible speaker at the last rally in September, and she's going to be speaking tomorrow at our rally. And Cece, I'll hand it over to you, and just what do you want to plug the event to the folks? Why should they come out, and what are you excited about?
What I want to say is, come out if you agree with us. Come out if you don't agree with us. Come out if you're not sure. Come out if you have questions. And that's the best way to learn. You know, we can't answer your questions unless you ask them. And we're going to have a few opportunities for you guys to ask them. What I always say is, you know, what's the worst that can happen? We clean up our air, we clean up our earth, and you learn a little bit. Like I said, if you have any questions or you're not sure, or especially if you don't agree with us, come out and visit and see what we have to offer. It's going to be really fun. The energy is going to be really cool. If you're walking out of school or work or whatever, I know that Inspire and Chico High are walking out at 9:30 a.m. and we are going to march on the Esplanade and make our way over to Trinity Commons. So if you're interested, please, please, please join us. And yeah, we're just going to have a lot of cool stuff going on, and you should be there. Yeah. I'm excited. I think it's going to be not just, you know, us sitting there talking about politics and climate. We're going to, you know, have a bunch of different performers and bands. And like Steven said, we're going to, you know, eat lunch together. And it's just going to be really fun. It's not only going to be this, like, you know, we just kind of sit there and angrily talk about what we believe in. There's going to be more than just that. And I think it's going to be really fun.
Yeah. Because that anger alone gets us so far. We have to build community in the process, and we have to love and respect the people around us in order to really build the future that we deserve. And we're hoping to build that community tomorrow, and to be continued in future events. But it should be a lot of fun. Tomorrow, the nationwide climate strike here in Chico will be rallying and striking all day at Chico State under the breezeway at the library. Come out. We'll be there from 9 to 4. Organized by Sunrise Chico, with a lot of different community partners supporting us along the way. And this is a youth-led event. Cece is a high school student. I'm in my mid-20s. What do you think the importance is of it being a youth-led event, Cece?
Well, climate change is going to affect youth. We are the future. We are the people who, you know, have the rest of our lives to live. And, you know, it affects not only youth, it affects so many more people. But I think the idea of it being youth-led is really cool, because it kind of shows that we're not just lazy and sit on our phones all the time like people think we are. We were talking about that earlier. It's we have a lot, you know, when my parents were kids, they were not involved in politics at 15 like I am. So I think the idea that it's youth-led is really cool because it shows a lot of the intersectionality of it and how it's progressed throughout the years and all that. Yeah.
Speaking a lot of truth for somebody your age, and I'm really grateful for that. Thanks for joining me on air. This is a really incredible episode. If you liked this episode, make sure you tune on every first Thursday of the month to the Youth for Justice program from 6 to 7 p.m. I am Stephen Markwart with my co-hosts here, Guillermo Mash, Ali Meadows-Knight, Mel Figueroa, and Cece Mahar in the studio with us. Thank you so much for coming on, y'all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Absolutely. Let's do this again. Let's keep building that community, and we will see you all soon.
Next up, Beatle Nation on Big Pop Radio.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4 1, 2
let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me.